Good evening, everybody. Thank you so much for joining our latest teleseminar on employment contracts and why they're so crucial. I'm Brian Torchin, the president of HCRC Staffing, your one call for all your staffing needs. Today we have a very special guest on tonight's teleseminar. He's an attorney, Larry Laurent, practicing healthcare law in Texas. Ms. Laurent has been doing healthcare law since 1990 in his present law firm, and he has memberships in the State Bar of Texas, healthcare, consumer, and business law. He's part of the Health Lawyers Association and the National Association of Chiropractic Attorneys. He's very well versed in all aspects of chiropractors trying to form interdisciplinary offices, and I personally have sent numerous clients to his firm, and a lot of my current clients also utilize his firm in helping them develop MDDC offices, employment contracts, et cetera. So, Larry, thank you so much for joining us tonight.
Thank you, Brian. Glad to talk to you.
Fantastic. So today we're going to be talking about employment contracts and why they're so crucial in today's marketplace. I have a few questions I'd like to kind of go over with you, and you can take as much time as you'd like to answer each question.
So first question is,
why do we need to use an employment contract?
Well, an employment contract basically is a document that's simply going to be used to set out parameters of what an employee should and should not do or can and cannot do for the employer. It's like oftentimes two docs will want to get together and share office space, and they want to both operate their own business but share the common expenses and what have you. They need an office sharing agreement because of all the various contingencies that can come up that would have an effect on them one way or the other. An employment contract is pretty much the same thing. It's a contingency meter, if you will, between an employer and employee. I don't regularly recommend that employment contracts be used for non-professionals, but I always recommend that any time a doctor is going to employ another professional for their office that they use an employment contract, because that an employment contract, depending on how exhaustive it is or how sophisticated it is or complex, however what way you want to describe it, can solve a lot of issues that may arise when a dispute arises between the employer and the employee. If it's not covered in an employment contract, and the only real way to resolve a dispute would be to go to court over the matter. If it is in the employment contract, the provision of the employment contract will govern. And courts routinely hold that if it's written in a document, if there is a written agreement, then that agreement is going to control over any side deal the parties may have had orally between themselves. So a written employment agreement can go a long, long way to help a doctor avoid a lot of extra cost if they get into a dispute with one of their employees.
Makes sense. That's fantastic advice. Is it crucial to always use a healthcare-specific attorney when setting up these contracts?
No, I don't think so. I am a healthcare lawyer, but I've been practicing for 43 years, so I've done a lot of other stuff. Any good transactional lawyer, you need to have a transactional lawyer. I would not recommend that, since all I do in my law practice is represent chiropractors. I deal with them every day, and I find a lot of the times when they need a lawyer, they'll typically go down to call their PI lawyer that sends them the most personal injury referrals and ask them to prepare a contract for them, and the PI lawyer typically doesn't do that sort of thing, so they're not really experienced in doing it, and so they may get it wrong, and they may leave stuff out or whatever. Any kind of good transactional lawyer that does contract type work of various nature can handle it for you. There are things when you're dealing with doctors and healthcare providers. There are specific things that need to go in a contract, an employment contract, that are healthcare specific. So you need to make sure that the lawyer you're going to use at least has a working knowledge of the healthcare laws and rules and regulations that will govern your profession that would be applicable in a particular contract. For instance, a non-compete agreement, which we're going to talk about, but we'll probably talk about later on. A non-compete agreement, at least in Texas, under Texas law, in order to have a non-compete agreement in a contract, there has for a help between healthcare professionals, there has to be certain specific language put in it. So if you use a non-healthcare attorney to put your contract together, that lawyer may not be familiar with that statutory requirement that is required by law to make it enforceable. So any good lawyer, any lawyer that deals in transactional stuff can do it, but a healthcare lawyer that deals in transactional matters is probably the best one to use, would be my best answer.
That makes sense. What about, I sometimes hear some of my clients tell me, and you probably see this too, sometimes chiropractors have another friend who's a chiropractor that has an agreement, and they kind of try to take that agreement and kind of cut and paste things in and out of it like a boilerplate for their practice. Is that okay to do?
I've seen that too many times in my practice where I've actually seen a contract that I wrote for somebody 10 years ago come back to me from somebody in another city for me to review that's been cut and pasted up. Yeah, I see it a lot. It's a really, really dangerous thing to do because almost invariably, every time I've seen something like that, the docs that cut and paste it have gotten it wrong. And you can do more damage by cutting and pasting the thing than you would if you just if you spend some money and go hire a good lawyer. I mean, in other words, it's going to may cost you more long term if you cut and paste it and it ends up wrong than right. The money you'd spend to hire a lawyer to do it the right way. But it's very, very dangerous to take a contract that someone else has done and then modify it to specifically what you want to put in there, because the relationship between different things that go in the contract oftentimes rely upon each other for legal enforceability purposes. And if you leave something out, then you may it may not be enforceable, or you may cause yourself some serious problems. Yeah, I see it a lot, and I don't recommend it. But you know, unfortunately, it's something that that happens quite often. You know, I've actually taken to where when I send a contract out to somebody, I do it as a PDF rather than I used to send them as a Word document so that they could make some changes. Now I just PDF the dang thing so that you know they can't dummy it up. But you know they can still cut and paste, so can't solve that problem completely. It is dangerous, though, Brian. Yeah,
guys, don't do that. No more sharing agreements, especially from different states. It doesn't give you the protection you're looking for. You know, a lot of my clients, you know, we staff so many different types of office staff for office. Does each category of, like, a staff member need an agreement? So, for example, you know, some of my clients will hire a physician, a nurse practitioner, and then maybe a front desk or a billing manager. Should they have a contract with each of those different types of hires?
I don't really see a need, at least in my law practice. I don't recommend to my docs that they do an employment contract with their non-professionals, in other words, their office staff. Now, a billing person might be a little bit different, especially if you're using a billing agency, you're going to have a contract with them.
Right.
But if it's a staff person and they don't have a license, they're a CA or front office or they're your insurance person or whatever it is, I don't really see a need to have an employment contract with them. One thing that is significant about an employment contract is an employment contract will typically take the employment relationship out of being what we call at-will employment. And at-will employment simply means the employer or the employee, either one, can terminate the employment relationship at any time they want to without any reason. They can just quit and walk away without any recourse. An employment contract, on the other hand, typically is going to have some requirement put in the contract that the terminating party has to do in order to legally terminate the employment relationship, like give the other party 30 days advance notice or something like that. So if you don't want your people to be at will employees where they can just walk out, then yeah, you could have a real short one-page contract that just that says, if you want to leave, you have to give us advance, you know, 30 days or 60 days advance notice so that we can get somebody in and train them to take over your position before you walk out the door. But typically, I don't advise docs that they need to have employment contracts with their office staff. On the other hand, anytime a doctor hires a professional, be it whatever profession it is, they need an employment agreement, and that employment agreement shouldn't just be a standard boilerplate employment contract they download off the internet or they cut and paste from somebody else, because it should be specific to that particular provider's own specific license. An acupuncturist may have different requirements that have to be in their contract, especially when you're dealing with you're putting in the scope of responsibilities for the employee. They need to be specific to that particular professional license. And there's even a difference between a professional, say you're hiring a physician assistant versus an advanced nurse practitioner. Both of them can do the same thing. They can provide medical services, but their license has different supervision requirements, and they're subject to different rules by their governing licensing board. So those, anytime you're doing an employment contract with a professional, it needs to be, you need to take care to have it case specific, if you will, to that individual licensee's own licensing requirements. So I say yes to the professionals, and not necessary with regard to your other people, unless you, for some reason, you know, want to require them to give you some advance notice, and then you can do a real simple half-page contract for them.
That makes sense. Okay. What are some of the important elements of an employment contract as it relates to the licensed professionals?
Well, first, you need to lay out your scope of duty, scope of responsibility. What's the individual going to be required to do? Are you hiring them as an associate doctor to simply treat patients and nothing else, with no administrative or supervisory responsibilities or anything along those lines? You put that in there. If in fact you're hiring someone that's going to have supervisory, say they're going to serve as your clinic director for physical therapy or something along those lines, you need to spell that out in there. So you need to make sure that the scope of practice, if you will, the scope of their responsibilities is spelled out in as much detail as is necessary to clearly define exactly what it is they're being engaged to do. Because if it's not in there, then obviously you can't hold their feet to the fire and require them to do it. You need to have a term in there. All contracts, all employment contracts need to have a term. It can be a term of 10 days. It can be a term of 5 years, but there needs to be some term where you have a beginning and an ending date. And typically what you're going to see in most employment contracts is they're going to be for either a year or 2 years, and then the term provision is going to have a provision in there that says it's what we call in the law an evergreen provision. That is, once that primary term of 1 year expires, the contract automatically renews for additional 1 year renewal terms, unless or until it's terminated by either some event or by the parties themselves. So the term that way you won't have to keep doing new contracts. That contract will remain in effect, and the terms will be the same unless or until it's terminated. You need to have, obviously, any contract of any nature has to have consideration for the services. In other words, the employee is providing services to the employer, and that's the employee's consideration, and the employer is going to pay the employee money for those services. That's the employer's consideration. So you need to set out the consideration in there. It needs to be spelled out. And I've had all kinds of terms of consideration that you can imagine to build into a contract. You can do it any way you want to. In addition to having your scope of your term, your scope of your duties, your consideration, anything else that is going to be that the employer wants to have specifically put in. For instance, a non-compete agreement or a non-solicitation agreement. You can build those in. Now, some states non-compete agreements are not enforceable. It's a matter of law, simply because a non-compete agreement, as such, is basically a restraint of trade. Okay, so typically, I mean, you could say in the truest sense, non-compete agreement is a violation of the antitrust laws because it restrains free trade. But states like Texas will uphold a non-compete agreement so long as they're put together properly. That's something that I see is messed up all the time when docs cut and paste documents on non-compete. So you can put a non-compete, a non-solicit, where you don't solicit patients or you don't solicit employees of the employer or something along those lines needs to go in. Confidentiality and non-disclosure agreements should probably be in a contract where the employee contracts to not disclose the terms of the agreement or any privileged or confidential information that the employer may give the employee during the course of their employment, and they're required to turn over any binders or office procedure manuals, anything along those lines that the employer has given them. In your termination provision, you need to, oftentimes you can put in a contract that just simply says the employer has the right to terminate the contract at any time they want upon giving the employee 30 days advance notice. Then you can put a little more burden on the employee simply because the employer actually needs more time to have some extra time to replace the employee if the employee is going to quit. It's like the employee, on the other hand, has to give them 60 or 90 or 120 days advance notice. They don't have to be
right.
The same. You also can put a provision in that says the employer has the right to terminate it immediately if the employee commits any particular act, such as getting sanctioned under their license or losing hospital privileges or being convicted of a felony or a misdemeanor involving moral turpitude or negligence or pissing off the staff or anything along those lines that you want to be able to get rid of an employee if it happens, you can put it in there. Okay? And I typically will end the whole thing by just saying, and the employer has the right to terminate it without cause if the employer determines that the employee has engaged in any kind of conduct that the employer deems to be detrimental to the proper functioning of the office. I mean, something just incredibly vague and generic that they
right.
can hang their hat on as grounds to kick somebody out that they don't want to. Other things, you need to put in what we call a venue clause, and that is if there's a dispute that arises between the employer and the employee, where is that dispute going to be resolved? In what county? In what court? You can
point.
Put in a lot of times we're going now to arbitration clauses rather than litigation because they're typically cheaper.
Right.
So you can put in an arbitration clause that says any dispute between the employer and the employee must be resolved in arbitration. And you can also put – I always put a clause in that says before you can arbitrate the clause or go to court on the case, you have to mediate it because oftentimes the parties can resolve the thing in mediation, and that's a lot cheaper than that. You need to put in – there need to be provisions in there, specific provisions about HIPAA along those lines. And so there are all kinds of things along these lines that a healthcare lawyer is going to know are required to go in, but those are some of the main ones that I would say that are must-haves in any kind of an employment contract with a professional.
Oh, okay, great. What about, like, for the non-compete, can you make it – can you be as specific as you want with the non-compete? Like, make it – because a lot of times some of my clients say they get pushback with the non-compete because the non-compete is basically stopping them from working anywhere within, like, a five-mile radius, let's say. Can you make it as specific as that you can't work for another MD, DC-type clinic if you wanted to do that?
Sure, you can do that. Now, what a state is going to do, what a court's going to do, anytime there's a non-compete issue, is they're going to look at it and make a determination as to what's fair to both sides, okay? Since I practice in Texas, under Texas law, the two criteria that you have to, make sure are fair and equitable is the duration of the non-compete agreement. That is, from the date of termination of the contract, how long is a non-compete going to be in effect? Typically, no more than 2 years is going to ever be upheld. And I'd say generally the courts in Texas won't uphold anything that's going to be longer than a year. Okay? And the other factor is the geographic restriction. You said 5 miles. 5 miles from from any location where the individual provided services for the employer. And
right.
What you'd do is you'd take a compass and you'd stick the pin where the employer's office is and draw a 5 mile radius from that point, and within that 5 mile radius, that person can't go practice. The courts will look at it and determine, is that, is 5 miles fair? In other words, is that going to be unduly discriminatory toward the doctor with regard to where the doctor can go out and practice? The theory behind a non-compete, obviously, is that the employer has given the doctor highly privileged information on the way this particular employee practices, all the nuances that this employer has developed over the years and how in practicing and becoming successful, their marketing strategies, the way their office procedures, and of utmost importance, their patient lists. And so the purpose behind the whole thing is to prevent the employee from taking all that information, quitting, going up and setting up shop just down the street and beginning to compete directly against the employer, using the employer's information that they gleaned through their employment against them. So that's why courts do enforce non-compete, but they're not going to make it too broad. They're not going to allow you to kick somebody, you know, out of their town where they live, if you will.
Sure.
And they'll look at it. There'll be a big difference between, say, it's an employment contract in the middle of Houston versus an employment contract in a little town that's got 5,000 people. Okay, you may be able to get a 5 mile radius in Houston enforced. You certainly won't be able to get a 5 mile radius in a little town of 1,500 people or 5,000 people enforced, because that would put them in another town. So
right.
Those are criteria that courts look at and determine, you know, whether or not it's fair and it's equitable to both sides, giving particular interest to allowing the employer to be protected against having the employee use what they've learned against them to compete for the same patient base. That's what the courts are just generally going to look like in deciding whether to enforce a non-compete. Also, I would point out that typically if non-competes are enforceable in a state, the courts of that state, if they deem the radius or the distance, the 5 miles, to be too broad,
right,
shouldn't be more than a mile, they're not going to invalidate the non-compete. What they'll do is they'll just simply say, I find that the 5 mile radius is too broad, but I find that a 2 mile radius is appropriate, so I'm going to enforce a 2 mile radius. So if the guy's say 3 miles away, then he's still then he's good, he's okay. But if he's
right,
a mile and a half away, he's still going to be, you know, subject to the non-compete agreement. So courts can modify them when they enforce them.
That's interesting. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
So you can really be as specific as you want, and even though it may not be upheld at some point, but the court could always modify it later.
Yeah. So in that sense, you know, I tell my clients, you know, shoot for the moon. You know,
right,
if you can, you know, you can pass the red face embarrassment test of putting in 10 mile restriction, put a 10 mile restriction in there. Worst it'll happen to you is the court will knock it down to maybe 2 miles.
Yeah, and also, I mean, maybe it's something the employee doesn't want to fight, and, you know, sometimes the contract is scary to the employee.
That's right. It can intimidate him into, yeah. Mm-hmm.
That's great. Absolutely.
There's an intimidation factor about that, yeah.
Definitely. A lot of times, you know, when they sign on and then they want to leave and they look at their contract, it scares them into, you know, not doing certain things, which is what, you know, I like about some of the contracts that I use for my own business.
There's one other thing. Let me throw this out there with regard to non-competes. As I said earlier, Texas has a rule that requires, if you're dealing with healthcare professionals, that in a non-compete agreement, you have to put in a provision that would allow the employee professional to buy out of the non-compete, pay the doctor X amount of money to be able to open up within the radius that is restricted under the non-compete agreement. And sometimes that's not a bad idea to put in anyway.
Yeah,
okay?
I like that idea.
But you've got to be careful when you do that, because there's a fine line between what we call under the law a punitive provision and one that would simply be what we call liquidated damages. Liquidated damages is enforceable. Punitive provisions are not enforceable. So the dollar amount you're going to put in for your buyout needs to be a number that if the employer doctor is called upon to sit down and put pencil to paper, he can actually work it out and come out with a formula that comes up with that number. Okay? But that's something that may be useful to your clients.
Definitely. But as before, let's say like they shoot for the moon with a really crazy number, and the courts look at it. The courts can also determine at a later date to make the number lower. Is that correct?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Oh, well, that's good then. So sometimes if you put like in a really kind of like a high number in the beginning, it might also put a little fear into the employee before they leave.
Right. Exactly.
I like that. That's good. How long does it typically take to draft these agreements?
It doesn't take long. I mean, most lawyers have a template that they'll use for an employment contract. Most of my clients think it should take me about 10 minutes because they think I've already got an agreement put together and all I got to do is replace all with their name and the other guy, but it doesn't work quite that way.
Yeah.
I'd say you're rarely going to find a lawyer that's going to have to put one of these things together from scratch. And if you do have a lawyer that says I got to put it together from scratch, I suggest you go to another lawyer because that lawyer probably doesn't do this very often.
Right.
I would say that it probably wouldn't take more than a couple of hours to put an agreement together at the most. For me, it wouldn't anyway. But it certainly takes a lot longer than 10 or 15 minutes, as the clients seem to think. But what you have to deal, there's usually a lot of what we call boilerplate language in a contract that's going to be in there. But all of those provisions that have boilerplate in them typically need to be modified to the specific nuances of what that particular client doctor is going to want to put in there. Because when my guys call me up and say, I need an employment contract for this guy, I'll say, that's fine. I'd be glad to do that. I need you I'll send them an email that has a laundry list of all different things that issues that can go into a contract and say, if you've got anything specific with regard to any of these issues, lay it out in as detail as you possibly can so that I can incorporate that into the contract. And so you'll use your same boilerplate, but then you're going to have to go through paragraph by paragraph, making the modifications that are specific to this particular employer's needs vis-a-vis what they want with their employee. So I'd say, at least a couple of hours, probably to expect a couple of hours to put it together.
That's great. That's well worth it. What about a bonus plan and that being in the contract and everything? Can you kind of like touch on that? I know a lot about especially for their higher level physicians, they like to have a bonus structure in there.
Well, a bonus.
Hello?
A lot of chiros, when they hire an associate doctor, they want the compensation provision to be based on a percentage of collections. Okay?
Right.
And that's kind of akin to a bonus type program, that sort of thing. Either way, whether you're going to set up your employment agreement, your compensation provision based on a percentage of collections, or you're going to give a doctor a bonus based on collections, or whatever it is. And when we're talking about a bonus, typically what you're talking about is the doc gets a base salary, say $3,000 a month, and then a bonus if collections attributable to the doctor's salaries are $20,000. He'll get a bonus over his $3,000. I guess that's what you're talking about, something along those lines. That's perfectly fine. You can do that. And you can do it based on a percentage of collections. I mean, if the contract can say the doctor if there's $5,000 collections, he's going to get 20% or 10,000 collections, he'll get 20%, 20,000, he gets 30%, whatever it is. You can do something along those lines. What you have to take special care for, though, is any time that there's a bonus provision going to be in there, and that bonus is going to be based on a percentage of revenue that the employer collects based on the services provided by the employee, there's going to be a presumption under the law that employee is doing as much as the employee possibly can by way of services to beef up those potential collections so that he's going to get a bonus. In other words, the employee has to make sure that his services are documented as to medical necessity. okay? Because whenever something's based on a percentage, there's a presumption that the doctor has overtreated in order to boost up those collections so he gets a higher percentage. And that's a really, really dangerous thing. And I've had lots and lots of problems with doctors that have done this on their own and have gotten themselves in trouble with it. You have to make anytime any kind of compensation is based on a percentage of collections, the employer needs to make dadgum certain that the doctor is going to be able to support everything that they've done. The exam findings are going to support the diagnosis. The diagnosis is going to support the treatment plan. The treatment plan is going to support the actual treatment program that's administered. And medical necessity has to be in there for each step of the way. Otherwise, the insurance industry is going to come back and say, these services are not medically necessary. We're not going to pay for it. So be careful, be real careful about that, because this day and age, as I'm sure you're well aware and probably your clients are all well aware, the insurance industry is tossing around the F word, fraud,
right.
Just like candy. I mean, anything that they see a doctor has done that the doctor can't support by way, you know, can't support for medical necessity or can't support by way of their exam findings or their diagnosis doesn't correspond, the insurance industry is claiming fraud. And that you don't want the insurance industry to ever claim fraud against you.
No.
So you got to be extremely careful when an employment contract is in any way, shape, or form, be it bonus or compensation, based upon a percentage of collections. That's a kind of a blueprint to disaster unless you're really careful and you put it together properly. I make sure in my contracts that I put in bold letters that the doctor is going to the associate doctor is required to fully and completely provide an exam, document the exam, and make ensure that the diagnosis codes are supported by the exam findings, make sure that the treatment plan is supported by the diagnosis, and so on and so on, so that if something comes back, if an insurance carrier comes back and says, you know, this is not medically necessary, we think you're just doing this to gin up extra money, providing medically unnecessary services, your upcoding or whatever it is, that the employer can kind of cover their ass or save themselves by, you know, making sure that pointing out, well, our contract says that this guy's supposed to be doing this, 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 and this, and if he's not doing it, then he's in breach. But we should be covered. So that's what I'd say as to that particular issue. You got to be really careful when you're doing that sort of thing.
Makes sense. That's a very good point. Hey, what's the best way for people to get in contact with you if they want your help putting these things together?
Well, my phone number is area code 512-996-8844. My email address is Larry, Laurent, Laurent, all one word, .com. Or you can go to my website, which is either www.LarryLaurent.com or ChiropracticLegalSolutions.com.
Well, fantastic. Larry, we appreciate so much all the advice and the information.
Can I throw one other thing in here real quick?
Oh, definitely.
Okay. One thing that I think that you need to make sure your folks are aware of, oftentimes when a doc comes to me and says, I want an employment contract, what they want me to do is they want me to put together an independent contractor agreement for them because they don't have to pay the employment tax. I need to make sure that your clients understand that the employer doesn't have a call. It's not their call to make as to whether it's a employment relationship or an independent contractor. That's the IRS's call. Okay, so you can't just hire somebody and treat them as an independent contractor when in fact the employer is dictating how they're going to carry out the duties. The guy's going to be there full time. He's going to get paid a weekly or monthly salary. That's not independent contractor. That's an employer-employee relationship. And the employer, if they treat it as an independent contractor, the employer can get dinged by the IRS for all of the back employment taxes, penalties, and interest. So it's a really dangerous thing for your folks to do is to try to treat what is, in essence, an employer-employee relationship as an independent contractor relationship.
Yeah, I agree. I sometimes will get calls like that a doc will want me to find them a doc to be an independent contractor, and I kind of run through that with them and explain to them that there are very specific laws and rules that the IRS sets forth to determine if someone's an independent contractor or an employee. And very rarely does a physician that you're bringing into your practice fall under the independent contractor rules. They're usually employees always. That's an excellent point.
Locum tenens can be treated as an independent contractor, but if the guy, the rule of thumb is if the guy is going to be there on a daily basis and he's going to be responding to specific, you know, specific office hours, and he's going to be paid on a weekly or monthly basis for the services, that's an employee, not an independent contractor.
Yeah, of course.
Thanks.
Okay. Fantastic. Hey, Larry, thank you so much for all the advice. And docs, if you have any further questions, please contact Larry at the number and email address that he left. If anyone has any questions for me, you can always call me at 267-251-5275. That's it for tonight, docs. Till next time. Speak to you soon. Take care.
Thank you, Brian. Appreciate it.
Thank you, Larry. Have a good night.
Bye-bye.